Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Finanzee Podcast, Episode 16, Part 1. Today, I'm joined by another renowned guest, Mr. Paul Pullman. Mr. Pullman has had a fantastic career in the business world. Mr. Pullman is best known for being the CEO and chairman of Unilever, the third largest consumer goods company in the world from 2009 to 2019. He also served as the chief financial officer and head of the Americas for Nestle from 2006 to 2009 and was president of Europe for Procter & Gamble from 2001 to 2006. Mr. Pullman is often regarded by many as one of the best CEOs of his time. He was named Investor Magazine's CEO of the Year 3 years in a row, as well as being named European Business Leader of the Year by the Wall Street Journal. Mr. Pullman has another side to him that he is very proud of besides consumer goods and business, which is his focus on ESG advocacy. ESG stands for environmental, social, and governance, the concept of corporate responsibility supporting the environment, society, and stakeholders. In July of 2019, Mr. Pullman co-founded Imagine, an organization to help combat poverty and climate change. Imagine aims to help companies meet UN global goals for sustainable development. And most recently, Mr. Pullman authored a new book called Net Positive, How Courageous Companies Thrive by Giving More Than They Take, in which he details how businesses can adapt to current situations and crises like climate change, ultimately reaping benefits for both the company and the world. I am beyond excited for today's conversation, and I hope you guys do enjoy it. So without further ado, Mr. Pullman, welcome and thank you for joining the podcast.
Thank you, Logan. Happy to be here. I hope you had an opportunity to read the book already.
I actually did. I think I read around 70% of the book. So I'm finishing it off right now. I really like it.
Easy reading?
Yeah, it's very simple, straightforward. I like also how you gave kind of like a beginning of what you were going to talk about. And then you kind of talked about like all the eight concepts you were going to hit in each chapter. So I really like that.
Good.
Great. Now, before we dive into your Unilever career in the consumer goods industry, I was wondering, could we get an intro for our listeners as to how you got started in business and how did that eventually lead to you becoming the CEO of Unilever?
Well, to be honest, Logan, it's a little bit of serendipity. Although we have all our objectives, my planning has never been so good. I actually always try to create as many opportunities as I can and then pick the right one, don't look back and move forward. And that's a little bit what happened to me with my career. I'm actually what you might call an accidental CEO. I never wanted to be a businessman. I wanted to be a priest when I grew up. I wanted to be a doctor. I grew up about 10 years after World War II when I was born, and much of the efforts of my family, my parents, was towards building the communities again, being sure that we got education, that there was peace in Europe and many of the other things. And their interest was entirely focused on us, giving us a better life than unfortunately was taken away from them. And that's how we grew up. In fact, my parents met in Boy Scouts, so nature and respecting the planet Earth was a very big part of that as well. As unfortunately, I couldn't study medicine. In Holland, we have a lottery system with the government and a limited number of places. You have to find something else. So I ended up doing economics. You know, most people take economics or law. For me, it was economics, but I wasn't very motivated. I went to the U.S. after 3 years of studying in the Netherlands to improve my English at that time, to think a little bit about whatever I wanted to do in life. And I ended up at the University of Cincinnati, believe it or not, amongst all other places. There I met my wife right away, so that was an incentive to stay. But the university was kind enough to allow me to study there. And I did my economics, I did my finance degree. So it was an MA and an MBA. I got hired by P&G and a Cincinnati-based company. And my first assignment was back in Europe. In those days, people wanted to hire MBAs from the US, but with a European nationality or background. And I started my career in P&G, moved around different places and learned certainly the discipline of an American company. The marketing, obviously, of P&G is very well renowned for, and a company built on long, you know, strong values. P&G started in 1837, when two families, actually Procter and Gamble, went together. They were married to the same sisters and started their company and moved from candle into soap and other things. Great career, a great company, and still is. And then from there, when I turned 50, I moved to Nestle. I wanted to retire, to be honest. I thought I'll do something else than business. I'd started a major charity that was actually taking off and needed my attention, and it's still growing. But then Nestle called and said, "Don't you want to work here?" And after a few reflections and a long discussion, I ended up moving from being a someone who was running the businesses as president of Europe when I left, a group president. I ended up becoming the CFO of Nestle, totally different job. At that time, I had to learn the difference again between a balance sheet and an income statement. But at Nestle, I discovered a great company that is run for the long term, very much connected to the emerging markets, to the local communities. And it gave me a broader perspective after P&G, which is a very American-centric company, if I may say so. And then the opportunity came to go to Unilever. As a coincidence, they were looking for the first time outside for a CEO. A company wasn't doing as well as it should be doing, and they decided that it was time for a change. So that's how I came in and spent 10 wonderful years there with an organization that was amazing, and building that business back and doing that in a more responsible way, actually showing that business can be done differently, moving away from this simple myopic focus on shareholder primacy and building in these longer term business models and multi-stakeholder focus, putting sustainability at the core of the strategies, and trying to really be a company that that profits from solving the world's problems and not creating the world's problems, as I mentioned in the book. And I did that for 10 years. I think that's long enough for a CEO to be there, and you don't want to overstay. I had a very good successor who was actually better than I am, so then it's time to move on. And I found that moving from this formal authority or bought authority as a CEO, I'm now living a life of purposeful play, which is basically built on moral authority. And actually, the things I can do now is imagine with some other things I've created are actually more impactful. And all my focus right now is on trying to ensure that the private sector moves faster towards this more sustainable and equitable world that we're all looking for. And given the challenging situation that we see at governmental levels, also in the US, may I add, it's even more important that businesses step up and fill that void.
Nice. No, I love that. But You mentioned that you wanted to retire after Procter & Gamble, is that correct? And then you ended up doing another 15 more years of consumer goods?
Well, retire, I don't like the word retire, Logan, because it sounds like you were tired before and you're tired again. And that's not exactly my spirit on how I approach life. I had the fortune to see Simon Peres before he died. He was in his 90s and he had a very young mind. And he was talking to me about Startup Nation Israel and all these incredibly creative companies that were there. And I said, you know, how do you stay so young? You're 90 and yet you talk like an 18-year-old and so enthusiastic, full of energy. And he said, very simple, Paul, age is all relative. You stay long when the list of things you have to do is longer than the list of things you have done. And I've always tried to live by that principle.
No, that's great. Now, I think obviously you're most proud of recently your new book that came out. So I want to dive deeper into that. So your book, Net Positive, and the points you discussed, but I think an important question to ask you before we do so is, what does a net positive business do? And could you further go into depth regarding the five principles you mentioned in your book that makes a successful net positive business?
So the reason we wrote this book, Logan, is because we wanted to start a movement to reframe what good looks like. Last year, the World Overshoot Day, which is the day that we use up more resources than the world can replenish, was July 29th. You could argue that every day after that, we're actually stealing from future generations. We're living well beyond the planetary boundaries. A economic system of unlimited growth on a finite planet is just simply not possible. And anything you can't do forever is by definition unsustainable. So we need to change our economic model. If you look at the last, human beings have been around for you know, for quite a limited amount of time in the history of mankind. But yet in the damage that we've done basically in this generation has been enormous. Climate change is obviously one of the bigger issues that we have to deal with. Destruction of biodiversity would be another one. The growing inequality that we see again in the world. So what we really need to do is to ensure that business profits, as I mentioned, from solving the world's problems, and that businesses can answer a very simple question: that is the world better off because my company is in it, yes or no? And if you can't answer that in the positive, affirmative way, you really have to pivot your business models if you want to be around still. Most companies are still in what you call the CSR mode, corporate social responsibility, which is really in the end about being less bad, but that's just not good enough anymore. I used to kill 10 people, so I was a murderer. Now I only kill 5 people, so I'm a better murderer. It just doesn't work. So then people say, okay, I understand that. Perhaps we should move our business models to become more sustainable, which is neither good nor bad. But frankly, in a world that has overshot its planetary boundaries and where we every day pay the consequences of that, like COVID being one of them, it is very important that we start to think regenerative, restorative, reparative. And this is really the essence of the book Net Positive. And the 5 principles, Logan, that you refer to are just basically very important principles that are as much human as business principles. The first one is to take ownership of all the impacts and consequences of your presence in the world, intended or not. Many companies still outsource their value chain and also think they can outsource their responsibilities. That just simply doesn't work anymore. We need companies to take the responsibility of the total consequences. Right where you are living, for example, a company like Facebook does tremendous good things to allow their platform to educate people, to bring people together, to connect, to communicate. It's really admirable what they have built. But if you also don't take responsibility for child addiction, hate speech, undermining democracy, you're not doing your job. The second principle really is to operate under the long-term benefit of business and society. It is your employees, it is your communities, it is the partners in your value chains that really built your business. It's not just about maximizing shareholder return or getting just a simple financial return. Of course, we need profits. Profits is a little bit like white blood cells in your body, Logan. We need profits to survive, or white blood cells in our body, we need to live. But we don't live for white blood cells. I've never met a fellow human being that says, I'm so motivated today because I have a little bit more white blood cells. Or this is a great day because I can live again for my white blood cells. And that's the same with profit in a company. We need profit, but we need to live for something more. And that is obviously where this multi-stakeholder concept comes in, and looking at a positive return for all of your stakeholders. And increasingly, we can show that companies that do that, that are operating these more responsible business models, are actually doing better as well. It also means that shareholder return, which you still want, is a result of what you do, not a myopic objective. With this myopic focus on shareholders, we've seen a lot of dysfunctional behavior. The companies have become more short-term. They haven't invested in the longer-term resilience that they need, or the longer-term growth. We see a lot of, this is now the era where many of your generation leave companies because they feel that just simply pursuing profits is not really that motivating. They want to work for companies that improve this world, make it better than they found it, have a little bit of a bigger purpose than just enriching the shareholders. And the last principle that we have is you really need to partner to drive these broader systems changes. The issues of climate change, inequality, food security, deforestation, and the list goes on. These issues are of such magnitude that none of us can really solve that alone, that we need to really rise to the level of working together in different ways than what we've done before. And that is what these net positive companies do. So yeah, I think it's a very practical book because it's written by someone, as you rightfully said in the beginning, that has run a big company, publicly traded, one of the more important companies in the world. And also we've been able to show that that is a very good way of running the company. Over the 10 years, we've been very successful in shareholder return. We've been very successful in growing the company, even compared to the competitive set. So this doesn't have to come at the expense of your shareholders ultimately. And it's very practical, talking about how to do it and sharing the best practices. That's probably why people rally to it. It's at least it's off to a good start.
So I guess ultimately you're kind of saying is a company, well, a net positive company, they should focus more on how they can improve the world or make it a better place. And that could be like reducing carbon footprint. And then usually profit comes afterwards because as a result of doing what you feel is right.
You know, if you run your company well and you take care of all the people that help you run the company, then these people will work for you. What we've seen during COVID is a lot of people had no safety nets around them. They lost their jobs and they couldn't survive. They ended up under the bridges of the cities that you live close to, San Francisco, Los Angeles. We've seen a lot of stress in families of if they were going to keep being employed, if their children could work or not. That resulted in mental health issues. We've seen a lot of disruptions in supply chains where people just couldn't get the materials that were needed for their businesses to function. And we've seen some behaviors of people where they took care of themselves, increased their own salaries or tried to, only give return to their shareholders, whilst others had to pay a significant price of this enormous crisis that we have. These companies in general don't do so well. Companies that ensure that everybody in these companies can make a career, irrespective of skin color or sexual orientation. Companies that have a higher purpose, where you work more than just earning money. Companies that treat their suppliers and their employees better, really found themselves with a more motivated workforce, with stronger relationships, and actually better results. So what we're saying is, operate your businesses under these longer-term multi-stakeholder principles, which is really how business started. We've just lost a little bit of that in the last few decades, and we need to go back to that, and everybody would be better off. We would, businesses cannot succeed in societies that fail. And in America now, there's a big part of the people that are left behind. There's an enormous poverty. 80 million households are $500 away from bankruptcy. The car needs to break down or they need to have a medical emergency. Most people that are hard workers have not seen their incomes improve in the last 4 or 5 decades, whilst cost of schooling or medical care or housing have gone up tremendously. So they've actually seen their incomes come down. That's why you see that high level of angst or dissatisfaction. Nobody is served by that, nor is anybody served by the fact that we've lost 68% of our species in the last 5 decades. Some people call it the sixth greatest extinction. COVID is a direct result from that destruction of biodiversity. Another zoonotic disease like Ebola, Zika, SARS, Asian flu. And yet again, it's the poor people or the ones that are already getting the wrong end of the stick that suffer disproportionately. When Black Americans die have twice as high a mortality rate than Caucasians, when the most important workers that we have, the healthcare workers or the transportation workers or the people that work in our factories, don't have the safety nets when they lose their jobs or when they're being sent in, when they know they might get COVID because the bosses refuse for cost savings reasons to provide them protection. Those are not economies that can survive long term. These are not systems that we want to live in. So companies that understand that address these issues, that increasingly see them as more as opportunities, will do well, because these are the companies we want to keep around. Companies that help us make this a better world sounds good to me. Companies that make this a world that doesn't work for everybody, that are driven by greed or apathy or selfishness, I don't really want to deal with, nor do I want to buy from it. And your generation, the millennials, the Gen Zs, increasingly are starting to differentiate on that basis. So it's not only a more profitable and smarter way of running a business under this multi-stakeholder concept, it also is increasingly being demanded from people like yourselves, hopefully, who start to spend more and more money as they come into the workforce.
Got it. Now, Another thing you mentioned in your book is the Unilever Sustainable Living Plan strategy implemented to help turn the company into a more net positive business. Could you elaborate more on what the USLP plan was and how you're able to execute it so successfully?
Well, it's really going back to the roots of the company. When Lord Lever started the company in Victorian Britain at the end of the 19th century, the issues of hygiene went so of such an importance that one out of two babies didn't make it past year one either. So he got this brilliant idea to invent the bar soap. Soap is called Sunlight or Life Boy. He called it big soaps that are still around today. You obviously know Dove soap in the US. So his whole mission in life was to make hygiene commonplace, as he called it, to give everybody an opportunity. Refrigeration wasn't invented yet and all the other things. And he operated under a concept of what he called shared prosperity. He built houses for his workers before the factories were fully up and running. He guaranteed 6-day work weeks. He introduced pensions in the UK. So this man actually, although he was very successful, spread that success amongst all the people that were contributing. And the company kept growing and growing and growing. So what we did, again, when we came in and needed to build the next phase of the company, we went back to the history and looked at what Lord Lever did and actually learned from that and made our purpose not anymore making hygiene commonplace, but making sustainable living commonplace. Because really, this linear consumption model that is using up these scarce resources, providing all these negative externalities, as I explained before, wasn't really quite working anymore. And the Unilever Sustainable Living Plan is actually a quite bold plan that now is increasingly more emulated by more and more companies, but was kind of new in those days. If you put yourself back 10, 12 years ago, we said we were going to decouple our growth of the business from environmental impact. So no more burden on society. We were going to increase our overall social impact, making commitments, for example, of reaching over 1 billion people, improving their health and well-being, creating jobs for people in our value chain, improving livelihoods for smallholder farmers and women. And most importantly, we did that with our brands. We're a consumer goods company. So a brand like Domestos, which is a toilet bowl cleaner, one of its goals not only was to grow and grow profitably, but it was going to do that by addressing the issues of open defecation. When 1.5 billion people still don't have access to toilets, for example. And by building these toilets, by being close to these people, by understanding them, we were better in innovations and growing these brands. A brand like Dove is helping women get self-esteem, when frankly, in many countries, women are really dealt the wrong end of the stick versus men. A brand like Lifebuoy, that bar soap, we simply said, help a child reach the age of 5. This is still a world in many parts of the world where we lose 4 million children per year before the age of 5 on infectious diseases like pneumonia, diarrhea, that can be solved by just simple hand washing. So we put our brands to the service of society, to addressing these bigger issues. And because these issues are so big, it's actually unlimited growth. What we found was that these brands that had that higher purpose to address some of these societal challenges were actually growing faster and were being more profitable as well. And they became an engine of company growth. We also found that by having more diversity, 50% of our management was women, 50% of our board was women. We had very strong programs on driving diversity in our company. It resulted in a more engaged workforce. We also found that being pioneers on taking climate action and trying to reduce our carbon emission in our value chain actually saved us a lot of money, but also put us well ahead of what we're seeing now with carbon pricing and all these things, but actually made very good business sense and creating a more resilient value chain. We also found that taking care of people in our value chain, enforcing the human rights principles that so many companies still shy away from, paying people decent wages, actually pays out in higher loyalty and more productivity. Running our factories at zero waste. You know, nature has not invented waste. Nature doesn't have waste. Everything gets reused in nature. Nature regenerates itself. Waste is a concept that we have created as human beings. So the good thing is, if we have created it, we can also undo it. But there is no place for that. You know, all the packaging in the world, only 8% gets currently reused. 92% gets ditched in the incineration. Landfills are increasingly in the oceans. That's not a way to live, nor is it a responsibility that we can take, depriving resources from future generations. So when we built this thinking in our business model more and more, we saw this business model becoming more resilient, stronger, actually more competitive, and started growing. So that's really the essence of the Unilever Sustainable Living Plan. We didn't achieve all of our targets because we set very audacious targets, what the world needed. We also required partnerships that were sometimes difficult to start. But broadly, we ended up in a significantly better place than we otherwise would have been, and I think have shown to many people that we need to be a little bit more courageous as companies in terms of addressing these issues and taking responsibility for that. In our case, being partly a food business and partly a personal care business, it was issues like deforestation, which is a big driver of climate change, or issues like poverty among smallholder farmers. Monocrop farmers is really where you find a lot of poverty. Issues of food waste or obesity related to food consumption habits. All these things we have to take responsibility for to try to help solve. That's what net positive companies do. And if you embrace those responsibilities, then I think society will respect you more, better people want to work for you. But you also see more opportunities to keep your company healthy and growing.
I mean, you are a man on a mission, Paul, and I think it's obviously important to acknowledge that there were probably some challenges when it comes to turning Unilever into this net positive business that you mentioned. So I'm curious, what were the greatest challenges when it came to helping Unilever become a more net positive company, and what was the greatest accomplishment in your opinion?
Well, probably, this is the work for many people, not only the 175,000 on the payroll of Unilever, but also the millions of partners that we have in our value chain. And the biggest challenge is actually between these two things called our ears, which is our mindset. If you think you can, you have half the answer. If you think you can't, you have the full answer already. So it's an attitude. You know, one of my blind friends always says, attitude is altitude. So do we care? Do we believe in it? Do we actually, are we aware of the issues that are out there, and do we feel compassionate enough about it to do something about it? So it starts with leadership. It starts with discovering your own purpose, because the road to change is never easy. And having a stronger purpose or an inner core, as you might call it, gives you more resilience to do something and to be more courageous. Courageous to set the targets that are needed versus targets you can get away with. Courageous to work with other people where sometimes you might have to deal with the inconvenient truths or others. Courageous to work with governments and others that at times might be frustrating but are needed to drive these broader systems changes. So that's the first part, start with yourself. The second part I already a little bit alluded to, where the challenge is really is in attacking some of these issues, you might just not be able to fully able to measure it. The technology might not be all available yet to deal with some of these issues. In some countries, you might simply not have access to green energy. And so you have to try to become part of a broader effort to help these countries or these industries change. Some of the things might simply be too expensive yet, and if you want to do it and others don't do it, it might put you at a competitive disadvantage. So then you have to create partnerships to do it collectively. I always say we should not really compete on the future of humanity. So more and more things you should drive to the pre-competitive level if it is that important. A good example would be plastics in the oceans. No company can solve plastics in the oceans by itself. But if you're a leading company and you want to be a net positive company, you form these broader coalitions to work together. You then work with governments to put systems in place like recycling and educating consumers or citizens to help as well. So the second challenge is in these broader partnerships that need to be solved. And the third challenge is a human challenge again, is just to be consistent. Every day you'll be tested, you know. When there is a crisis, are you going back to the short term and the shareholders alone, or are you able to be consistent? In how you implement your business models, are you being consistent in all of it? How do you deal with tax? Are you paying your tax? How do you deal with corruption? How do you deal with human rights? CEO salaries, which have risen way beyond the salaries that we pay other people in companies. Money in politics, as we've seen in the US. So for companies to be responsible citizens, and the same for people to live up to being really the great human beings that we all aspire to be, it's hard work. And you need to then also be able to deal with these challenges and dilemmas that come with these bigger areas that I just mentioned. So I would single those out as the three biggest ones between your two ears, the partnerships and doing in the dark what shines in the light, which is that consistency we talk about.
Got it. Now, you know, I want to touch base on another topic in chapter 3 of your book. This idea, I love this idea. I stick by it every single day. And this idea of being driven and motivated to put your best foot forward. And how do those two factors really make a difference maker when it comes to helping make the world a better place? I think our audience is curious about what drives you and why are you personally so determined to make positive changes in this world?
Well, Logan, although you have a whole life in front of you, you belong to a lucky part of the population that is educated, that clearly got a piece of bar soap because you made it past the age of 5, that got enough nutrition when you were born, so in your first 1,000 days, so you're not stunted like 160 million children that are born every day. You have the possibility to get wonderful education. You've already gotten that, but your further education will be there. Most likely your parents will support you in that system. So what have you done for that? You know, you have won the lottery ticket of life, but you've not done anything for that. It's your parents that you might argue that did that. But you belong to 5% of the world population that has that freedom, if you want to. And, you know, if you belong to the ones that have won the lottery ticket of life, which I certainly feel I belong to, then it's your duty, it's your obligation to put yourself to the service of the other 95%. Humanity cannot work if we don't fight for these basic values that are universal of dignity and respect or equity for everybody or compassion. And that should be your mission in whatever you do. Now, you want to do something that you feel very strong about, that hits your purpose, your inner core, that you're good at, and what the world needs. And if you can work on that intersection as you move forward, which I've been fortunate to do and continue to do as my purposeful play I'm currently involved in, then you can have a very rich life. You can then say, you know, I'm here to make this world a better place or leave it in a better place than I found it. I made a difference. I touched a lot of people positively. I gave other people the same opportunities that I took for granted. And that's really what life is all about. And I think that is one of the main, if not the most important reason why we are here on this wonderful planet Earth.
Great. Now, obviously, after you left Unilever, you decided to create your own company and co-founded it called Imagine. And obviously, we've heard a lot about the trend of climate change and social inequality. So I was curious, what is the mission? What is Imagine's mission and what do you hope it will do for the world?
You know, what is currently happening if you're a CEO and you're doing a lot of good things, because there's no CEO who wants more unemployment, more climate change, more people going to bed hungry. But we're optimizing within a current system when the system doesn't work anymore. So many of the things that the CEOs are held accountable for, like deforestation, like human rights, like plastics in the oceans, they can't really at a company level alone solve that. And it's very difficult for them to drive these systems changes. First of all, they spend a lot of time on just keeping their own companies alive, dealing with all the challenges of COVID and other things that come with it, or the effects of climate change, or the challenges that politics brings to these businesses nowadays. So what we said was, we need to accelerate the implementation of the Sustainable Development Goals, which are really universal goals that have as objective to irreversibly eradicate poverty and do that in a more sustainable and equitable way. But we need to do that by collectively moving businesses forward. And Imagine is nothing else than a neutral platform that we have created by industry sector, where we bring a critical mass of CEOs together across the value chain to drive transformative change. If you bring a critical mass together by industry sector, about 20% of the sector, 25% percent of the sector. The CEOs collectively become more courageous, but you can also start to address the bigger issues to then move the system broadly. Let me just be very concrete and give you some examples. We work with some of the most, the biggest industries in the world, but also the ones that have the biggest impact, obviously, on these sustainable development goals that I talked about. So fashion is a very destructive industry. We're consuming too many clothes, the way we produce clothes in terms of labor standards or in terms of resources that we use, like is not very good. Destruction of biodiversity, plastics in the oceans. Many people in poverty in the value chain. It's unsustainable. And the trend is not our friend. We have now 52 seasons. We have more clothes at home. Many parts of the world will also want to have that same standard of living. So how do you take, and every company is too small in fashion to make a difference themselves. None of them can really change markets by themselves. So we've brought together 80 companies in fashion. For example, over 250 brands that are connected to that. And together, we move to regenerative cotton. That's a major crop to use to build, make clothes. So together we change the market to regenerative cotton. Together we come together and eliminate single-use plastic from the value chain. A company alone cannot do that because a supplier might ask for this way of delivering, another supplier might ask for this way of delivering. But if you work together, you can get one standard. Together we actually work on buying energy, green energy. Every company might be too small to make a major investment in green energy, but if you aggregate that demand, you can accelerate the move to green energy. You might even jointly own a wind or solar farms and all those things. So that's an example of where collectively we identify these pre-competitive areas and move things forward. And we do this in travel and tourism. We do this in food. The food value chain is absolutely broken and needs to be reconfigured. And increasingly, we do that also, you'll be pleased to hear, with private equity. But private equity increasingly is finding out that it's not just only on earning money or leveraging these companies up and spinning them off again, but that the LPs that invest and provide the funding want to invest in responsible companies, because the people that give them the money, people like ourselves, are telling them that they want the money increasingly to do good as well as get decent returns. And also these companies need to be sold eventually, and you can only get buyers if these companies are responsible and if they're well run and if they're well positioned for the future, more sustainable and all the other things. So we see private equity coming in, and increasingly we want to help them build a new way of wealth creation that is more in line with not only with the shareholders, but also with the needs of the planet and our fellow citizens. So that's really what Imagine does. And so far, we're off to a good start. It's a social enterprise, actually. I think that's important for us. And there's an enormous need for that as industries in its entirety are starting to look for what it takes to become net positive.
Well, that's great to hear. So would you say, Imagine is more of a, I guess, guide and a place where companies, they can all meet together. They can find, I guess, like where they meet in the middle pretty much and see what they can agree on to help improve the world?
Yeah, the easiest way to see it perhaps, Logan, is that if one company has an idea, Coke has an idea, Pepsi doesn't want to participate because they're competitors. Or P&G has an idea, Unilever doesn't want to participate. Or a CEO might say, hey, if I have to do all this work, then the others don't do the work. Why should I work for them? Or some CEOs might say, hey, we need governments to also put better regulations in place. They're not quite the ones that we need to solve these issues. But it's very tiring to work with governments. And as an individual company, I cannot go there alone. So what Imagine does is provide that neutral platform, creates that critical mass, aligns these objectives, makes the CEOs more courageous to actually go the extra mile and feel a little bit more uncomfortable to solve these bigger issues. So it's an accelerator, I would say, in terms of the direction that we need to move.
Great. Now, I actually want to go and dive deeper now into the consumer goods industry, something you are, I'd say, an expert at. So To begin, I want to ask you, what does a consumer products company like Unilever do, and how do you compete or differentiate your products from other similar consumer products from like competitors like P&G?
See, I always like this industry because it's very close to the citizens of this world. And obviously, this industry has done a lot of good things, have also made mistakes. There's no question about it. But if you're in the fast moving consumer goods, it's called fast moving, you really get immediate feedback. Consumers can go to a store, which they do two or three times a week, and can choose between five or six brands of detergents or shampoos. And if you don't deliver your quality, the right products, the right price, and the right location, the right service around that, then consumers will quickly disassociate themselves with your product. So it's very hard work. And it's that competitiveness that have been created between these brands that actually drive innovation, that gives consumers an opportunity to improve their lives and to provide that better quality of living that we want to give to everybody. So the industry has an important role to play. You might argue there's some frivolous consumption. There is some stimulation of mass consumption when we cannot afford that. So there are things that the industry needs to start to adjust to. It's an industry that creates a lot of plastics that we can't really afford anymore. So, but having said that, it really provides these basic needs of hygiene, of oral care, of nutrition that have given us an incredible standard of living in many parts of the world. Now, the fact that it is so competitive is a good thing. If you go back into the history, in the countries where brands could not compete, take the former Soviet bloc or China before it opened up, people, North Korea right now, people have a very miserable life, to be honest. So when you create that openness, that innovation spirit, then I also think it is often associated with improving the quality of life of people. And that's really what should be the role of that industry. And companies that do that responsibly, with really focusing on improving the quality of life, improving the planet itself in the way they do that, addressing these real fundamental issues in a responsible way, I think are very well placed to grow and do well in the future. And that's really the role of any industry, but the consumer industry is probably on the foreground of that, because they're so closely connected to the citizens of this world. How do you differentiate? It's really to identify needs. You know, it's not different than any entrepreneur. An entrepreneur is really identifies in a unique way issues that need to be solved and goes passionately after that, just like Lord Lever wanted to solve the issues of hygiene in Victorian Britain. So they're driven by that and they're really focused on that. Very few companies started to because they wanted to earn money or to make the shareholders rich. No, they started because they had an idea, a problem that needed to be solved. And with a lot of determination and persistence, they went after that problem. So the same in consumer goods. You always look for unmet consumer needs, to bring in new innovations, to start to differentiate your brands from others in terms of driving things forward. And what we found, for example, and increasingly the business models itself are obviously part of that. And what we found was that these brands that really became part of a global movement to stop stunting, to help children reach the age of five, or to build toilets, or to give women self-esteem, or to create jobs if you want to, that these brands that have that broader positioning are brands that I think are very well placed in today's or tomorrow's world. There is a group of companies that is called the Benefit Corporations, the B Corps. You might have heard about them. And it's a way of running your company for the stakeholders longer term. Allbirds is a B Corp, seventh generation, Ben and Jerry's. And these companies are really the ultimate example of practicing this longer term multi-stakeholder model, trying to use your brands to solve bigger societal issues. And we found that once more in Unilever, that these brands have a big role to play there. If they do it responsibly, promoting, for example, in their advertising, gender equality, having the tougher conversations when there are tension fields in the world. Let's take in India, where Hindus and Muslims don't get along so well. You could use advertising to perhaps change that situation. When you want to have more women use for education instead of early child marriage. You can use your brands and advertising properly to change these cultural norms. So there is a lot of possibilities and responsibilities that come with the brands, not least to ensure that they don't have a negative footprint in this world, but above all, to ensure that, that they help improve the lives of the world's consumers or the world's citizens, may I say. Yeah.
So you ultimately kind of liked the consumer goods industry mostly because you felt like each company, each big company like Nestle and P&G, they just kept pushing each other. You know, I like to think of it as the way you described it, sharpening iron with iron and just pushing each other so you guys can find new ways to, you know, figure out how do you innovate? How do you make the world a better place? Is that kind of what you were saying?
Well, I'm saying that I like that industry because it really is an industry that can make a real meaningful scale impact to consumers' lives. So you could be a doctor, you could be a priest. These are all good professions to improve lives of consumers. They're of citizens, if you want to, of this world. There's no reason, obviously, why consumer goods companies cannot do the same. And I've been very fortunate working for very responsible companies like P&G or Nestle or Unilever. I think one of the reasons they've been around for decades, for centuries, is because they're actually able to maintain that relevance, that trust, that connection with the consumers. That's what I like. It's also very competitive, which is what I like as well. It's a little bit like the tech industry. That competitiveness is really drives this continuous improvement. It's like playing three-dimensional chess. Every day something happens that you need to then think, how do I react to that or how do I become better? So I like that. And it's a very human business. It's a very simple thing, you know. Too many parts of our economy have distanced themselves from the real world, the financial market being one example of that. This is a very simple industry where you sell soup and soap. You try to produce a few good ingredients and treat the people well that produce it. You try to put it responsibly in packaging and not pollute the world. And you try to give it to people that then take showers or add a little bit of water and have soup and soap and make their lives better. And that's the business. It's a very transparent and simple business in that respect. So I like that part of this, of it as well.
Now, I guess, you know, I am curious. We've seen a big trend in private labeled generic consumer products like Kirkland from Costco or Safeway Signature. So how does a company like Unilever compete with lower cost brands from your retail customers? Do you see that continuing or what major changes do you see in the near future?
Yeah, they don't need to be lower cost. And for a consumer, it's not a private label. I mean, I thought the peanuts in Costco are pretty good, you know. I bought the wine there because it had a very good price and a very good selection. You know, it's an, you know, but I would never buy the Kirkland fabric softener because it's just not a good quality for what my wife was looking for, or what I'm looking for. So for consumers, these things are brands. They don't say, I'm going to buy Kirkland instead of Tide or Ariel or Omo or other things. They're buying a brand. And what they're looking for is they look for price, they look for quality. And it's not always the lowest price or the highest quality. People might have different needs and also be in different stages of their life. Sometimes you can afford to buy the right brand, but it costs a little bit more. And sometimes you've run out of money, but you still want to get the basic benefits. So there are different needs. You know, you might have straight hair, you might have curly hair, you might have colored hair, and you might need different shampoos. So brands have to provide their benefits in both value, and that's a question of performance and price. But also increasingly, brands are statements. People, increasingly also the Gen Z and the millennial generation, they buy brands because it's an extension of what they stand for. You know, I buy this brand because this brand of clothes, because I feel associated with what the brand is trying to portray, liberty, equality, unisex. Or I buy this type of a brand or this type because it fits with my character. You know, impulsive or aggressive or soft and caring. So increasingly, what brands stand for and what brands do is an extension of what people believe in. That's why it's also so important that these brands have a deeper purpose. People increasingly buy these brands that at least we find because they want to be, again, once more part of something bigger than themselves. And if they feel that they make a contribution to creating more decent living or solving broader societal problems, then they want to be part of that. That's one of the reasons why many people are now buying vegan or vegetarian or buy brands that are sustainable or are getting interested in how women are treated or people are treated in general in their value chain. And if you can bring that expression to your brands, then people buy that. When Nike had one of their advocates for their brand, one of your sports people who had been criticized by other people in society because he kneeled and made a statement of equality for Black Americans. When Nike started using him in advertising, it was controversial for some people. But ultimately, Nike saw their sales accelerate because many people said, yeah, I can relate to that. I believe in that. If your brand stands for something like that, I want to stand behind it. When lots of companies spoke up because of the tragedy of January 6th, when in the US the elections were undermined, and said our brands are not going to anymore finance politicians that deny the election results, these companies actually saw their businesses grow because people felt, yeah, you have to speak up to defend these basic values. And if you stand for that, if your brand stand for that, it's an extension of what I believe in. I want to be associated with you. That's how you differentiate brands.
Gotcha. Now, I guess, you know, there has been a lot of acquisition of brands in the consumer goods industry. And I think this is kind of a big idea in the consumer goods. So I guess for you and for Unilever, how do you determine when to build and launch a new product versus buy a brand or entire company with many brands? Is it harder to build rather than buy a brand?
No, it's never black or white. I mean, it's difficult in big companies to build brands because, you know, in bigger companies, the people that work on the bigger brands tend to get more motivated or rewarded. People move around a little bit faster and it takes time to build a brand. Entrepreneur might not be the same as an entrepreneur. So you see a lot of people out there building brands to about $100, $200 million of turnover, but then they don't know how to scale it, how to make it global. It has to become more professional. You need to have other departments that have been built up. So it becomes less, to some extent, entrepreneurial. What we found in Unilever was a good combination of improving, optimizing our own brand, sometimes introducing a brand that we built ourselves, but also having an aggressive program of acquisitions. And during my tenure, we did 64 acquisitions, and we ended up with wonderful brands that became our partners, like Dermalogica, or Sundial, or Seventh Generation, and the list goes on. Tresemme, that you're familiar with, a suave complement in hair care. So it's a combination. But what I find is increasingly is that the disruptions actually in many of the industries don't come from the incumbents. And it's a sort of what people call an innovator's dilemma, but come actually from the new players. And look in Tesla was in the car industry. It's a phenomenal success coming from a player that never was in the car industry. Look at Beyond Meat, a tremendous success in the food industry, from someone that really wasn't in the food industry. So many of these disruptions are actually happening on the fringes or the outside. And if you run a big company like that, you need to play in both. You need to be very good internally with your innovation processes, but to be also very in tuned externally to tie in. And what we found in Unilever was that a lot of these companies wanted to work with us because they felt that that their values, which are often, you know, B Corps, as I mentioned, with strong social values, strong environmental values, match those of Unilever. And instead of going to private equity or selling out to other competitors that had not done that journey so well, they chose Unilever, not always because they could get the highest price. No, because it matched their values and our values. So what do you look at for successful acquisitions. First, to establish, Logan, that very few acquisitions actually built value. Some people study this and write about it, but 75% of these acquisitions fail because they were not thought through, or they tried to satisfy some eco objectives that weren't very good. But if you buy a healthy business, if it brings in a complementary benefit that you don't have, if this business has a core that is really able to stand on itself, if the values are aligned between you and the company that you are associating yourself with, I think we're talking the ingredients of success. Unilever had a very high success rate on acquisitions, and it was a key part of our overall success. By the way, by making them run independently and using a lot of the founders, which are still with the company, we also made Unilever more entrepreneurial because it sort of rubbed off on the rest of the business. So I like that part of it as well.
Thank you so much for tuning into today's episode, part one. Be sure to check out next month on February 11th, where we'll be releasing part two, in which Paul talks about his leadership strategies he implemented at Unilever, what he believes makes a great leader, and leadership in the business world. I'll see you guys soon. Take care.